This podcast of To the Point is a production of KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com. Support for KCRW podcasts comes from the Southern California Lexus dealers.
From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
Local elections and national trends. Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To The Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. In Virginia, New Jersey, and California, Republicans lost big time in yesterday's statewide elections. President Bush himself took a hit in Virginia. Democrats claim momentum is on their side for next year's congressional showdowns. Republicans say forget the national message. All politics is local. On To The Point, we'll talk about winners and losers and look for signs of political change. Has the president become a liability to his own party? Is celebrity politics on the wane in California? On Reporter's Notebook later on, Ahmed Chalabi and Tony Blair, Iraq and domestic politics on both sides of the Atlantic. First, here's the news.
Support for To The Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Hello again, Warman Alney, back with To The Point. Has President Bush become a liability to his own party? Has California just said no to celebrity politics? On To The Point, do yesterday's statewide elections hold a message that's national, or do they prove once again that all politics is local? On Reporter's Notebook, Ahmed Chalabi's back in Washington. Tony Blair suffers a major defeat. We'll talk about the war in Iraq and domestic politics on both sides of the Atlantic. First, this news update. The high price of oil and record industry profits were the subject today as a joint Senate committee grilled executives of the oil industry. Here's Republican Pete Domenici of New Mexico.
I want to ask you, and please, in the few minutes you have, somebody describe in detail how the price of oil is set. Because I close by saying, if that is not rational, then are you rigging the price of oil?
Republican Senator Pete Domenici of New Mexico. Elizabeth Souder covers the oil industry for the Dallas Morning News. Elizabeth, thanks for joining us.
Hi there.
You surprised to hear a Republican senator asking a question like that? Are you rigging the price of oil?
Well, I think these days it's not surprising to hear anybody ask that, with voters and consumers so frustrated with the high gasoline prices.
Let's listen to one of the responses from one of the most powerful business people in the world, the chair and CEO of ExxonMobil, Lee Raymond. Here's part of what he had to say.
But when you look at our earnings per dollar of revenue, a true apples-to-apples comparison, we are in line with the average of all U.S. industry. Our numbers are huge because the scale of our industry is huge.
Back to Elizabeth Souder. Did the senators seem to be satisfied with that kind of answer?
Well, no. The senators didn't seem to be satisfied. They're trying to understand if big oil companies were able to manipulate supply or prices in the past few months, and if so, if a tax would be a fair thing to levy on them.
Now, we're talking about a possible windfall profits tax. Is that right?
That's right. That's a suggestion that has been made, a windfall profit tax or some other kind of tax to sort of balance these huge earnings that the oil companies have been reporting.
What real sentiment do you think there is for a windfall profits tax, particularly from the Republican majority?
Well, you know, the largest calls for windfall profit tax seem to be more from the Democratic side of things. The Republicans don't seem to be as excited about this idea. In fact, some seem to agree with many economists that a windfall profit tax might have a negative impact on the oil demand and supply because it would decrease incentives for oil companies to bring supply to market. And that's what we need oil companies to do, is to bring even more supply to market because our demand is running ahead of supply.
It sounds like the politicians would like to talk like they want to punish the oil companies, and in response they got Economics 101.
That's what I heard when I was in there.
that kind of response. Here's how it works. How much transparency, though, is there in the oil industry? And were the executives really able to explain what they do and how much money they're making in a way that's going to go over with the public that is, as you say, angry about gasoline prices?
Well, first off, I think it's that the energy industry is very complicated. And I've talked to a lot of analysts lately who said it's very difficult to explain to, you know, regular folks all of the intricate things that have to happen to get oil from the ground into your gas tank. So as the executives were sort of trying to explain how it worked, there was some frustration on the part of senators. They didn't seem to think that their questions were being answered. However, there was one point that seemed to stick out to me as very interesting, and that is that the markets, the international market for petroleum is not transparent. It's notoriously intransparent. We don't know how much oil is produced exactly. It's hard to understand why certain countries want certain prices for their oil and why other countries might not want as much. And there are many different kinds of oil that, and refining the different types of oil is requires different types of complex processes. Some are less expensive, some more so.
Did the oil industry take the opportunity to ask the Congress for anything?
I'm sorry, did they take the opportunity to ask the...
Ask the Congress for something. I understand they want to get permits for building new oil refineries.
Absolutely. There were some things they asked for. They would like the process of building new refineries, the permitting process, to be less onerous, to be easier. It takes about twice as long to build a refinery in the U.S. than it does in China because the permitting process is pretty... in depth. They've also brought up the point that in the U.S. about 24 different kinds of gasoline are sold in various cities and states and regions because each area has its own sort of flavor of oil that it would like. And that creates some supply bottlenecks as the companies try to supply that particular kind of oil in the right quantities.
All right. So the oil industry then submitted to the grilling from the Joint Senate Committee. Windfall profit tax seems unlikely. We'll see what does come out of this. Meantime, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks so much.
Elizabeth Souter, staff writer for the Dallas Morning News. In a moment, we'll be talking about local politics and national trends on To the Point.
To the Point thanks Factiva, a Dow Jones and Reuters company, for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 8,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Mormon Alney back with To the Point. In the aftermath of yesterday's statewide elections in Virginia, New Jersey, and California, political pros are reading the results and the tea leaves. One place where it all comes together is on the Hotline, National Journal's daily online briefing on politics. John Mercurio is a senior editor. And John, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you. Good to be here.
One of your correspondents, Chuck Todd, today writes that some Republicans almost wanted to see their party go down to a defeat in these statewide elections as a kind of wake-up call. What's that about?
That's definitely true. In fact, I was emailing this morning with Frank Luntz, who's a pretty prominent Republican pollster, who actually describes yesterday's election results, in which, as you said, Republicans suffered some pretty devastating defeats, as a silver lining, as a present in disguise, if you will, because of the notion that the Republicans have been concerned on the part that the White House has been sort of oblivious to the weakness of the party heading into the 2006 elections, and they hope that these results, which are relatively limited in terms of national scope, will sort of wake the White House up and allow them to sort of reconfigure and retool heading into 2006.
Are they particularly focusing on the president's last-minute appearance in Virginia?
Well, I think that was a huge risk on the part of the White House and on the part of the Kilgore campaign. I mean, we've been seeing polling for several weeks in the Virginia governor's race in which voters were saying even the Republican base had been saying that they were less inclined to vote for Jerry Kilgore if he directly associated himself with President Bush. Now, this is devastating if you consider the fact that President Bush won the state of Virginia, the Commonwealth of Virginia, twice by comfortable margins, and just a year ago by about 9 points. So for voters in this state to now be viewing him unfavorably, his ratings are only at about 40% approval, shows that even in red states, states where Republicans should feel comfortable, they're having trouble.
Is Virginia really a red state, or is it kind of turning purple?
Well, I live in the Washington suburbs myself, so I'm sort of watching the changes go on, and the changes in Virginia are happening in the Washington suburbs. It's becoming the Northern Virginia region is quite rapidly growing, and that area of the state is definitely trending Democratic, and that, I think, is fueling this sense among Democrats that the state is increasingly competitive.
If, in fact, the president is in trouble, as indicated by what happened in Virginia, what do we learn from the results in New Jersey?
If the president is in trouble?
Yeah, is he in trouble there too? Is there the same message coming from Virginia, from New Jersey, I guess, is a better way to put it.
Right, very different state, and I think a very different message and a very different campaign. I mean, you have so many different dynamics. First of all, the state of New Jersey is historically a Democratic state, and I think that even on both a state, a local, and a presidential level, it's been reliably Democrat over the past several years. So I think that if the Republican had pulled off an upset victory in that race, Doug Forrester had pulled off an upset victory, then it would have been perceived as a real bonus for Republicans. But the fact that Senator Corzine, was able to win and win relatively comfortably, not a huge surprise. Also in that race, you had such an excess of money being spent by both candidates, by both Corzine and Forrester, both of them self-funders to some extent, both multi-millionaires. Difficult to sort of ascertain what exactly the ramifications for the president or his party are in that race.
Well, New Jersey, though, has been, as you said, traditionally Democratic, but it's been regarded by Republicans as in play, has it not, in national elections? And here comes John Corzine, who has one of the most liberal records in the Senate, who wins big. Does that tell you something?
Sure. And I think it's over the past two or three presidential election cycles been on a Republican wish list as a state that they want to be in play, much like Virginia has been on a Democratic wish list. Although it never seems to bear out for Republicans in the state of New Jersey. I think what we're going to see that it could be very interesting is now that Senator Corzine has won, he basically has to vacate his Senate seat. He can appoint a temporary successor to fill out the remainder of his term, which ends in 2006. But next year, what this does is it creates a potentially very interesting Senate race for his seat, in which the Republicans have already recruited a very strong candidate.
Okay, and in both states, there are incumbent Democratic governors, and we want to talk about them in a moment because they're very interesting as well, especially in the national picture. John Mercurio, once again, the senior editor of The Hotline, the National Journal's daily online briefing on politics. Ross Baker is professor of political science at Rutgers University, author of House and Senate, a comparison of the two houses of the U.S. Congress. Ross Baker, Professor Baker, always good to have you with us.
Thanks, Warren. How are you?
I'm well. You're somewhat skeptical, are you not, about the idea of drawing national conclusions from these statewide races? What do you say to what we just heard about even Republicans saying that they better have learned a lesson, particularly from Virginia?
Well, I was kind of amused by Mr. Mercurio's report of what Frank Luntz had to say about the kind of secret rejoicing about the defeat. I think if it was a blessing in disguise, it was certainly well disguised. I think, however, particularly in New Jersey, I think that there were issues that were just so distinctive to the state. Certainly the longstanding skepticism of New Jersey voters, often bordering on cynicism about the integrity of public officials, that was certainly one factor that I think that made Doug Forrester perhaps more competitive than he might have been. The polls indicated that his very consistent being on message on the corruption issue probably did help him. A more intriguing question is, what effect did John Corzine's ex-wife Joanne have on voters when she gave an interview to the New York Times and was quoted, and this was picked up by the Forrester people, as saying that John Corzine let his family down and he'll likely let New Jersey down as well. And, of course, Forrester ran that as an ad without other commentary. Some people were really kind of appalled by it, and others thought it really it caused people to have second thoughts about Corzine. But, you know, Corzine did win easily. Property taxes, the perennial issue in New Jersey, not a national issue. I think it really was. I think if the Democrats are rejoicing about New Jersey, I think that's fine. I think they probably need a little morale boost, and if New Jersey could produce it, that I think is good. As for Virginia, I think you had an unusual candidate in Tim Kaine, a Roman Catholic, and proudly so, in a predominantly Protestant state, who took on the issue of the death penalty very forthrightly in an extraordinarily candid way. And I think just proved to be just a better candidate. He also had the blessing of Governor Warner, who's been a very popular governor. And I think that these were sort of distinctively local issues. And I think that you read national significance into it at your own peril. I think that I think, as I say, the effect on Democrats is largely kind of spiritual and morale.
Quickly, with regard to the death penalty, you said that Tim Kaine in Virginia was very candid about it, Roman Catholic that he is. What did he say? What's his position on it, and how did it play in the campaign?
Well, I think certainly the Kilgore campaign made a very big point of indicating that he opposed the death penalty personally and ran some very, very hard-hitting ads. Kaine countered with a statement, which he reiterated on many occasions, and that was he was obliged to follow the laws of the Commonwealth of Virginia. And he would do so even though he was personally opposed to the death penalty. And apparently that message got across. People, I think, credited him with honesty. I think contributed to his victory.
Russ Baker, again, professor of political science at Rutgers University. Back to John Mercurio, senior editor of The Hotline. Anything you want to add to what we just heard from Russ Baker? Anything you want to disagree with?
Nothing that I necessarily want to disagree with. I agree with him very much about Tim Kaine and the sort of the strength that he showed in his position on the death penalty. One little fact that I was just thinking about before the show started that's very interesting, where a lot of people today obviously talking about the political future of Mark Warner, the outgoing governor of the state of Virginia, very popular as he prepares to leave office. He, by my count, is the only potential 2008 presidential White House hopeful who helped bring home a winner on Tuesday night. You had George Allen, obviously, who campaigned for the Republican nominee in Virginia, Jerry Kilgore. He, of course, lost. You had Rudy Giuliani, who was campaigning for Doug Forrester, who made phone calls and, I believe, ran a television ad for him. Forrester lost. You had John McCain, who campaigned for Arnold Schwarzenegger's initiatives in California, all of which went down to defeat. Hillary Clinton campaigning for Freddie Ferrer, the Democratic New York mayoral candidate, who, of course, lost terribly. And yet Warner, who, of course, had, I think, an easier sell with Tim Kaine in Virginia, his home state, but still sort of interesting that as these candidates, you know, are reading the tea leaves and preparing to sort of assess their own strengths, Warner really does come out of yesterday with a huge bump. But again, maybe just a spiritual and a morale bump, but certainly one to take note of.
Russ Baker, you mentioned that earlier, but how strong a bump do you think former Governor Warner got?
I agree with John completely. I think that at this stage, he sort of looks like the un-Hillary. I think for Democrats who, for one reason or another, have some problems with Senator Clinton, I think that Mark Warner now emerges as a possible alternative. It's certainly other than John Kerry, the only other name that seems to be floating around, and particularly this morning with some regularity. So I think absolutely, I think that Mark Warner got an enormous boost out of it.
Back to John Mercurio with the Hotline. If there was a blessing of sorts in Virginia, well disguised as Ross Baker said that it was, do you think that the Bush administration is listening? Did they get the message if, in fact, there was such a message? And if so, how would they respond to it, according to Frank Luntz or others that are feeling that way?
That's a very, very good question, and it's actually one that I'm going to admit I don't have an answer to. I do think the White House is listening. I'll give them credit for, you know, enduring a relatively difficult politically time in the administration, distracted by so many issues, both domestically, you know, internationally, and within the White House, which we all know about. I do think that they're keeping tabs on this, and they're looking at the midterm elections in 2006. And you know, I know that some of the political staff within the White House, not necessarily Karl Rove, but other members of the political staff, are meeting with the House and the Senate congressional committees, talking about recruitment, talking about fundraising at the RNC. So they do have their finger on the pulse to the extent that, you know, they possibly can. What lessons they take from yesterday, I don't know. I don't know what lessons they will actually appreciate and what lessons you know, they'll try to rationalize away.
So, Ross Baker, even though you don't want to see national trends necessarily, based on the idea that these elections are primarily local, do you think that there could be some impact if, in fact, changes result of the sort that John Mercurio is talking about?
Sure, I do. And I think a lot of it has to do with the state of mind of members of Congress, the 435 House members who are up, the 33 senators who were up in 2006. I think that members of Congress are doing a kind of seismographic reading on the Bush administration and determining just where they should position themselves. This would be Republicans, of course. How much distance they want to place between themselves and the president, and I think that kind of calculation and calibration is going on right now. And I think from the point of view of people who are making these kinds of measurements, that yesterday was the kind of day that might suggest to them that it's every man for himself, and you sort of better prepare for the 2006 election based on your own merits rather than any kind of help the president might give you.
Not very good news for the White House. John Mercurio, if the president, as he said earlier, wants to spend political capital on a radical agenda, or I should say a he doesn't call it a radical agenda, but a you know, an important agenda. I'm running out of adjectives here, but anyway, bad news for the White House. And again, you said you're not sure how they might cope with this. Any speculation about it?
In terms of how they might cope with...
Yeah, what might they do? Might they go back to Social Security? Are we going to hear about that again? Or are we going to go to tax reform? Or what sort of initiatives might we look for? Or are they just simply stuck with Iraq?
I think that we've learned from congressional leaders, Republican leaders in Congress, that Social Security is probably off the table for the rest of the president's term. Chuck Grassley, the chairman of the Senate Finance Committee, said yesterday that he doesn't expect to see any sort of meaningful Social Security reform until 2009, which would, of course, be the beginning of the next president's term. In terms of what sort of agenda the president might pursue in 2006, I think we saw to some extent a revelation in their strategy in the president's decision to choose Samuel Alito. He returned to sort of an effort, a strategy on his part to motivate his base, a conservative base. I think that sort of ideology or that sort of philosophy would extend to an effort to return to a sort of a tax cutting agenda for 2006, and I know that they're pursuing other immigration reforms and other environmental regulation reforms too. So I think to some extent, the president's success for strategy in the past has been sort of hewing to his conservative base.
We'll see more of that. Thanks to you both, John Mercurio, Ross Baker. Come back in a moment and talk about California's election yesterday on To the Point.
Transcripts of To the Point are available from the Transcription Company, 818-848-6500, or on the web at transcripts.net. A CD copy of To the Point is available by calling 1-800-600-5279.
Warman Alney back with To the Point, and once again talking about the ripple effect of yesterday's elections. Just 2 years ago, Arnold Schwarzenegger replaced a governor of California who was recalled in midterm, and Schwarzenegger was wildly popular with Republicans and independents and even with Democrats. Democrats as well. Yesterday, Schwarzenegger suffered a crushing defeat. All four of his so-called reform initiatives were defeated by the voters of California. Sean Steele is immediate past chair of the California Republican Party. He's also director of the California Club for Growth, supporting limited government and lower taxes. Sean Steele, good to have you back with us.
Yes, good day.
What happened to your man?
Well, I think the man was very ambitious, too ambitious, with up to 9 complicated propositions were on the ballot. By taking on too many reforms, which were widely embraced, 2 of them particularly by most newspapers, which are not right of center, it was too much to do. And plus, he ran against a Susumi of $150 million of union money that was carefully, intelligently spent. That the union strategy of beating up and demonizing the governor is quite effective. And the governor essentially ignored that until the last five weeks of the campaign, thinking that his star status could turn that around. So strategically, we're back to status quo. Nobody's changed power. No possessions have changed. No positions have been lost. We're exactly the same place. The unions still have the same amount of power they have to take money away from their own union members. But I think there's going to be a good deal of blowback and ripple effect for what I think is a pyrrhic victory. A couple of the propositions were very, very close, but it still isn't a win. I think there's a lot to learn here, but I think the governor's reelection chances are surprisingly good, notwithstanding what you may hear a lot from the press. But I think the propositions themselves had they were hard to explain, hard to fathom, and a lot of folks got into the syndrome of, I'm just going to vote no because it's confusing. And when it gets confusing, that's what voters tend to do.
Should he have put the election on the ballot at all? He was the one who called it.
Well, that's one of the great questions that we asked, Monday after the football game on Sunday. And right now, it looks like it was a poor idea. It looks like that because it was... good, intelligent political analysis was not rendered by the governor's people, particularly, some of the outside advisors. He's supposed to have some very interesting, fresh-thinking people, but it turns out that it was fairly stale political thinking, and having the special election went right into the union trap. It was going into an ambush alley. They should have seen it coming. They still held the special election. The unions were waiting and ready for this to come.
Just for our listeners around the country, the four propositions that the governor was supporting had to do with changing tenure requirements for new teachers so that they'd have to wait 5 years instead of 2 to get tenure, requiring public employee unions to get written permission from every member before they spend any dues money on politics, limiting spending in California and giving the governor new powers to enforce spending limits, and giving reapportionment of the legislative and congressional districts to a panel of 3 judges and taking it away from the legislature itself. Sean Steele, still with us, again, formerly chair of the California Republican Party. Do you think those reforms now are dead in California, and will that have national repercussions?
I don't think there's going to be national repercussions, because remember, the same redistricting reform, which virtually every newspaper, Common Cause, and several center and groups endorsed, the same issues were in Ohio, and that was rudely shaken and blown apart. So Ohio voters had the same issue, except the unions were on the other side. They were in favor of having a different form of political redistricting. So in any event, folks in New York and Virginia and New Jersey, just about everywhere, seem to go for the status quo. However, the problems of unfunded pensions, which has nearly bankrupted the city of San Diego, and of course Republican won that election on that issue, this problem is not going to go away. Financing the huge pensions that union members get in California, which is probably the most generous in the world, more than any other state in America and more than anywhere else, it will cost billions and billions of dollars that presently is now unfunded.
Okay. All right. Sean Steele, once again, a former chair of the California Republican Party, supporter of Arnold Schwarzenegger. Mark Cooper is contributing editor to The Nation magazine, columnist also for the L.A. Weekly, and a senior fellow at the USC School for Institute, rather, for Justice and Journalism. Mark Cooper, welcome to you.
Thank you, Warren.
If Arnold Schwarzenegger took a big loss yesterday, who won?
Well, in the immediate sense, obviously his opponents win. Let's not defy logic here. When you lose an election, you lose. And Arnold Schwarzenegger lost. Whether he liked it or not, whether it was intention or not, this election played out as a referendum on his leadership and on his governance, and he was handed about as big a defeat as you can imagine. Now, Sean may be right that we don't know yet about whatever his reelection chances might be, but whatever they are, they're diminished by this defeat. And second, what really happened, if you'll allow me, is that voters rejected the entire, they weren't confused. I don't agree with my friend Sean. I don't think voters were confused at all. I think they were very clear about this. I think they got up and they said, you know what, Arnold Schwarzenegger is trying to tell me that when I get up in the morning, what I'm most concerned about in the future California is the $6 or $8 or $10 a month that some union members have to pay to their union that then gets put into, you know, into Democratic politics. And that might be a problem, but on the scale of world problems and on the scale of problems facing Californians, it's about number 400 on the list. When Californians get up in the morning, they worry about what everybody else worries about. They worry about their jobs. They worry about education. They worry about medical costs, etc. And if the governor had come to the people with, which I'm going to agree with Sean, with his most reasonable proposal, which was the one to redistrict the state and to say, you know, let's get the drawing of political maps out of the hands of politicians, he probably would have won the election overwhelmingly. But when he links that to what was a very partisan agenda that, for better or for worse, singled out only union members as special interests in a state where the pharmaceutical companies had no problem coming up with $80 million for their own initiative, which lost, by the way, people don't buy it. They say this is unfair, it's one-sided, and yeah, we may not like the big power of the unions, and, you know, yes, there are things wrong with the teachers' union, et cetera, but you know what? We're not silly enough to believe that those are our only major problems facing us. And the governor grossly miscalculated. He got the heck beaten. He got the stuffing beat out of him last night, and he's in a world of trouble right now.
Mark Cooper with The Nation and the L.A. Weekly. Arnold Steinberger, I always say that when we're talking about Arnold Schwarzenegger. Arnold Steinberg is a Republican political strategist whose clients have ranged from Clint Eastwood to Mayor Richard Reardon, and he's been watching all of this very carefully as always. Arnold Steinberg, good to have you with us.
Hi, Warren. You know, I hate to sound anticlimactic. I think the big winners were the television stations.
Because they got all that money from the advertising.
All that money for these ads, infinitum, that I think had a very limited effect on the electorate.
Well, let's talk a bit about Arnold Schwarzenegger. When he became governor in what is pretty much a blue state, it would appear, certainly from this election, he had support across the board. But he's become, as Mark Cooper suggested, a much more partisan politician in the past few months. Do you think that had to do with the fact that he was being touted as a possible presidential candidate? We had Orrin Hatch and others talking about changing the Constitution to let an immigrant run for president.
I think that was a small part of his appearing at the Republican National Convention, but I think the real problem from my standpoint as kind of a libertarian conservative who favored a lot of his policies is that he got the image as a polarizer, he got the downside of polarization, but he didn't really get anything done. In other words, people walked around saying, look at how he polarized opinion, he polarized the electorate, but, you know, he could have gotten things done when he first came into office. So by my judgment, he has the downside of polarization, but not the benefit of getting something done that would have brought about the polarization.
What does that say to the future in California? He's now got to still work with the Democratic legislature, which is happy to see what happened to him, and may not want to cooperate. As he said last night, let's roll up our sleeves and cooperate. Is he really in a position to do that?
No. I mean, he's got to rehabilitate himself, and I'm not sure exactly how, because tugging at his sleeves are going to be people who are saying, you ought to move left because you were too confrontational, and there are people on the right that are going to say, hey, look, when you were popular and came into office, if you had attended to some of these things and gotten them out of the way, you would have had more leeway now.
Back to Sean Steele, you're confrontational when it comes to politics. Is that the mistake that the governor made? Is it time to make nice with the Democrats?
I don't think you're going to see the governor really recanting and giving up what turns out to be pretty modest proposals that he offered the public. What he did not anticipate was the ferocity and the organization and the money of government unions. What's he going to do next? The biggest clue is going to be how he changes his staff. And if we start seeing, former Assembly Speaker Democrat Bob Hertzberg turns out to be the chief of staff, then you know the governor's going to be moving left. He also opened the door for raising taxes. But one big part of his campaign, although he was outspent 2-1, part of his campaign was telling voters, look, if you don't vote for this reform, we're going to be seeing more taxes. That implies to me that he'll be increasing taxes, moving to the left. That, of course, will alienate, the stalwart Republicans. He's got his hands full. The magic of Arnold has worn off. We thought that he might be a new kind of a human political species that was going to redefine politics and do things differently. But I have to agree, it was a stunning defeat, but it was a bit anticlimactic because it really didn't, in California we saw this coming in agonizing slow motion detail. It wasn't really any great surprises. What he does in the future, only Arnold knows, and I bet he doesn't know himself.
Sean Steele, immediately past chair of the California Republican Party. The magic has worn off Arnold Schwarzenegger. Mark Cooper, you said it's hard to tell about his reelection prospects, those coming up, of course, next year, but that they were diminished. Is there anybody around who can beat him? Does California want another celebrity running for governor? Warren Beatty, for example, has been mentioned and has apparently been toying with the idea.
Well, starting backward, I think you've put it perfectly. I think Warren Beatty is toying with the idea, and he's only going to toy with it. I don't see any real possibility that he's going to make a serious run. It's hard to say, really, Warren, which way this goes for either party, because I agree with Arnie that and with Sean that there's no easy way out for Arnold Schwarzenegger. I mean, theoretically, he should move to the center now and try and recover some of the ground he's lost. But I don't think that Bob Hertzberg or any Democrat wants to be seen within 100 miles of Arnold Schwarzenegger. He's kind of radioactive after last night's defeat. There's certainly, why would a Democrat now come to rush to save Arnold Schwarzenegger? On the other hand, the Democrats have two leading candidates, possible candidates out there for governor. One is named Phil Angelides, and the other is named Steve Wesley. They're the treasurer and controller of the state of California. But you might go, huh, who are they? What were those names again? And that's part of the problem. So, as I said, Governor Schwarzenegger's spectacular perspectives were for re-election in 2006 have now been greatly diminished, but that doesn't mean the Democrats are about to win.
Mark Cooper with The Nation magazine and the LA Weekly. Arnold Steinberg, back to you. Again, Republican political strategist on the sort of libertarian side of that party. What about celebrity politics? California has become known for that. Schwarzenegger's had a lot to do with it, of course.
You wrote that Warren Beatty started to look too much like Richard Nixon. I think Warren's problem is that, when you ask him a question, his lips start moving, but it takes another 30 seconds until the words come out.
So you don't think Warren Beatty is the ideal candidate, even if he's doing more than toying around with the idea. But what about celebrity politics in general? Did they take a hit yesterday? Were people saying that maybe somebody who's been an actor, even though he's been the Terminator in movies of that kind, may not be able to mow down the opposition?
Oh, I think so. And I think they didn't have to take a hit because I do think Arnold Schwarzenegger is enormously capable. But I think he may have a bit of that superstar syndrome where he's so used to getting his way, he can't adapt to a collaborative political environment.
What does that say, though, then, about politics and about the possibility of people who come from the outside, amateurs who appear to have easy solutions often to complicated problems? Is that an era that's over? Or are people tired of that?
Not necessarily. I mean, I think you have to accept the fact that Arnold Schwarzenegger really is more than an actor. He's quite a businessman. And Clint Eastwood was more than an actor. And some of these people are just actors. They're very bright people, but they're actors. There are other people that are entrepreneurs, creative business people, and people who are leaders.
Sean Steele, back to you. You've been the chair of the California Republican Party. Are there any national implications to what happened here in California? You mentioned a moment ago what happened to reforms in Ohio, but what about the about Republican politics in general, with Arnold Schwarzenegger having been such a political star? Has he now diminished nationally? Is the idea of the political celebrity of this kind also sort of in question at this point?
Well, in terms of his star diminishing outside of California, probably not. He's still considered the great action hero. The one thing the unions couldn't and didn't do was to demonize him outside of California. He's still a popular figure. Any group outside of California would love to have him speak. He's seen, you know, as a great charismatic leader. His problems are, of course, internal in California with, you know, with the $100 million plus campaign ads against him. And now he's got a year to wade through that. The Republicans in California are not terribly distressed. I mean, it was like a high point. Well, can we gamble and get these initiatives done? Can we get lucky and get through them? And no, none of the luck was there, but there's no lost ground, and Arnold's considered to be a very formidable candidate for governor next year. He comes across last night as contrite, as Arnie mentioned, positive. The Democrats are going to have to do a lot better than what they've proposed so far. The two gentlemen mentioned by Mark Cooper are just not exciting anybody, particularly the Democrats. So his reelection prospects looks relatively good. So nationally, not much damage to Arnold. Internally, he's got a lot of work to do, but he's a bright guy, and he'll probably figure it out.
Mark Cooper, do you see any national implications to this, either with not necessarily with regard to Schwarzenegger, but to some of the issues that were on the ballot and the role of unions in politics?
Well, I see it the opposite way. I think that the national implications of the present moment infringed on last night's election. That is, that the peaking unpopularity of the Bush administration undoubtedly rubbed off on Arnold Schwarzenegger last night. And I exist in a slightly different world than either Arnie or Sean does. And I can tell you anecdotally, there was a bit of a hidden vote last night. There were a certain number, I don't think it was a great number, but there was a certain number of Democrats out there who set their alarms at 5 a.m. and made sure they were there at the polling place at 6 o'clock for any opportunity to vote against Republicans.
All right. That's all the time we've got. Mark Cooper, Arnold Steinberg, Sean Steele, thanks for being with us. In Washington, Ahmed Chalabi is back. In London, Tony Blair suffers a big defeat. Back in a moment with To the Point.
You can find more information on the program, including archived editions, at www.moretothepoint.com. More to the point, all one word, .com.
Warren Olney back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. When Ahmed Chalabi met today with Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice, no cameras were allowed, but Chalabi told reporters that the session went very well. Adrian Woolridge is U.S. correspondent for The Economist. He is based in Washington. Adrian, good to have you back on our program.
Good to be here.
Is that unusual for cameras not to be allowed when the Secretary of State meets with a high-level official like this?
I think it's probably unusual, but this is a very strange and interesting high-level official.
Strange and interesting in what regard?
Well, in the sense that he is the subject of a certain amount of investigation as to whether he leaked certain secrets to the Iranians. He's the subject of a great deal of interest as to whether he actually misled the Americans into going to war with Iraq, whether he deliberately circulated false information about Saddam's weapons of mass destruction. This is a man who could not be more controversial if he tried.
And in 2004, American forces raided his home in Baghdad.
Exactly. There was a time, it seemed, when he was almost on the American enemies list, that he went from being America's best friend in the region to being one of America's prime enemies in the region. Particularly, I think Colin Powell was absolutely furious with him. And yes, there was a falling out, but now he seems to be back in favor, or at least certainly talking to the administration in its various guises.
What's happened in Iraq to improve his standing with people here in the United States?
Well, I think that he is influential in Iraq. He has brokered various deals with religious groups, and he has got a certain amount of support. He's in charge of the oil I think he's deputy prime minister. I'm not quite sure about that, but he's certainly got a lot of influence over what's happening with the oil. And he is an important person for the administration to be dealing with, partly because of his contacts in Iraq, and of course partly because he's got a certain entree in Iran, which the administration doesn't have. So he's a power broker in that arena, and in politics, of course, you deal with the people that you have to deal with.
He is, once again, meeting today already with Condoleezza Rice, soon apparently to meet with Vice President Cheney as well. And yet he's also talking about improved relations between Iraq and Iran, this at a time when the leader of Iran, the new president of Iran, has said once again publicly that Iran would like to wipe Israel off the map. How does that, do you think, reconcile? How's that reconciled by American officials?
Well, I think it's extraordinary because the statements the Iranians made were as inflammatory as you could possibly make, yet Chalabi, as is wont, has been playing both sides against the middle, has been recently in Iran. In a sense, you'd imagine that the administration would want to have back channels, but whether it would want to be publicly associated with somebody who's so closely linked with, who's recently been to Iran, at least, it's strange. The whole thing is has an odd feel about it in all sorts of ways. And not least, of course, because there's been this long-standing debate about Chalabi's role in the run-up to the war and about his relationship with Cheney and whether he was feeding Cheney information and his poor relations with the CIA. And I had expected that Cheney wouldn't see him, actually. I think there was a certain debate about whether Cheney would see him because of ongoing, let's say, tensions between Cheney's office and the CIA over intelligence. But he certainly seems to have seen him today.
Talking with Adrian Woolridge, who's U.S. correspondent for The Economist, based in Washington. Something of a throwback, one would guess, to the controversy over the Iraq war occurred in Britain today when Tony Blair took what's being described as his first defeat since 1997. Can you tell us about that?
Well, absolutely. I think the Iraq war is something that we can't get away from in domestic politics on either side of the Atlantic, and it's something that we keep refighting. But every time we refight it, the people who are against the war seem to do better than they did the previous time. And this happened very much today in the British Parliament, when a majority of MPs, I think a majority by 30 people, voted against something that Blair had pushed very hard, which was keeping prisoners without trial for, I think, 90 days. Blair was very, very adamant about that, and he was defeated. And this is a man with a 60-seat, roughly 60-seat majority in Parliament who just won a re-election, who's just won. That was the third time, only time that Labour has ever won three elections in a row. He was a man who came with a certain amount of authority after that election, and now his authority has been hugely undermined by this defeat. It's his first ever defeat since he was elected Prime Minister.
And this comes in a action that has to do with the war on terror after the bombings in London.
Absolutely. You'd imagine that those bombings in London would have created a certain feeling for cracking down on terrorists. And, of course, we have these huge riots going on in France at the same time, which some people associate with Muslim extremists. But no, people said that, you know, that habeas corpus and the rest of it, that the tradition of English liberties matters, that you don't keep people for that length of time without trial. And I think a lot of people felt passionately about that, but also a number of people undoubtedly wanted to use this to embarrass the Prime Minister. They certainly embarrassed the Prime Minister, and he is now a very weakened figure.
What does that mean in terms not only of British politics, but of his international standing and the importance of his association with President Bush?
I think that, interestingly enough, the former British ambassador has just to Washington has just published his memoirs, a book in Britain, Sir Christopher Mayer, in which he says that Bush was almost, he didn't use the phrase poodle, but he said that he was overawed by American power, that he didn't do enough to question Bush or to slow down the march for war. And I think there's a general sense that that this is a weakened prime minister. This is a prime minister who is primarily weakened by his association with the Iraq war and with the American president. This is somebody who's desperate to get back to domestic politics. He wants to put public sector reform at the center of his third term, but he was constantly being dragged back to the question of the war. Why did we fight it? What sort of information did we have? Was that information wrong? And why was it wrong if it was wrong? And every time these issues come back, they come back in a more embarrassing form.
back to the visit today by Ahmed Chalabi here in this country. Is that something that you think will get a lot of attention in England? Is it is he as prominent and controversial a figure there as he is here?
Not really. I mean, I think he is quite controversial there, but I think people haven't heard about him as much as they have here. I think there is a very interesting question that the British would look at, which is, you know, who is running Iraqi policy? What sort of coherence is there in Iraqi policy when we can go from putting this man almost under house arrest and then raiding his house on the one hand, and then inviting him here a year later when you can have the CIA, which has been burnt by him and is very antagonistic to him, and which regard him as peddling deceptive intelligence, whether it was deliberately deceptive or not, I don't know, but deceptive intelligence on the one hand, and then him going to see Cheney, and Cheney's and Condoleezza Rice, and I think Rumsfeld he's seeing as well, and Stephen Hadley he's seeing. On the other, is this an administration that has a coherent policy in Iraq, or are different bits of the administration singing from very different hymn books?
And Mr. Chalabi, of course, positioning himself, one would think, in a public way, looking forward to the elections in Iraq coming up in December.
Absolutely, and he's a person who has got a certain political skills. And you can see why that certain people in the Bush administration might think he's a good figure. He's a highly westernized. He is a secular figure. He's not a religious figure. There is a case for doing what they're doing, but it is still very surprising that somebody with such a track record and somebody who is not exactly beloved of the Justice Department in this country should be here seeing the Vice President and other people.
Adrian Wilbridge, as always, thanks a lot for being
with us. Thank you very much. Thank you.
U.S. correspondent for The Economist based in Washington, D.C. Today's program produced by Sharon Rembaum with Jonah King and Katie Cooper, technical director Mike Newport. You can listen online anytime at moretothepoint.com. I'm Warren Olney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live as a co-production of KCRW's Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.
You've been listening to KCRW's To the Point. KCRW offers more than 20 podcasts, including Left, Right, and Center, our provocative, up-to-the-minute, witty confrontation over politics, policy, and popular culture, with Matt Miller, Robert Scheer, Tony Blankley, and Arianna Huffington. Check out the podcast of Left, Right, and Center at kcrw.com.